You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Megan Abbott, screenwriter and author. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
I mean, I would say that there's so many things about you that are so special and unique and beautiful. And probably the things that you think are ugliest about yourself are the most beautiful. And I always say to young writers, you just, you know, put your heart on the page and don't worry about being like anyone else. And I would say that foremost in any of the arts is it is self-expression at its core. And I don't buy rules or a set criteria or aesthetic criteria. I don't believe in any of that. And I think the most exciting talents are kind of inexplicable. You know, you can't really understand why that art works. It just does. And that feels like it comes from a very pure place. I think that it all goes back to childhood. I was always really writing about family. I suppose we always are. I do think that it is the original wound, and it's where we are kind of wired and built from those early years. So I think every other relationship just replicates that. So it's very natural for me to go there, I suppose, because of that. The feelings are most intense there. And we just keep what the famous Freud essay, remembering, repeating, and working through. We just keep recycling these relationships and dynamics over and over again until maybe someday we can catch ourselves and try to break the bad patterns. So I think it just feels the most visceral and real to me always. You're always looking for that in writing. You want everything to be at this peak intensity, or at least I do. So that seems always like the most natural place to start. Or even if I don't start there, I end up there. I mean, just a psychotherapist, not a strict psychoanalyst, but yes, I definitely count on that. At first, I was hesitant because I thought it might disrupt my creative brain, but I've been able, I don't talk to what I'm writing about with her. I keep that separate. But for my mental stability, I need her for the sessions. And that is good for writing. I mean, not that it just has to be good for writing, but the more the vivid memories that you shared, like that stuff is, of course, gold because it's in us. It's working on us all the time. And if we don't excavate it, we have no control over it. So I think having to talk every week for an hour about myself, which is really useful, it just stirs things up. Of course, you start to see patterns in your life that you want to break. And yeah, you inevitably end up talking about your childhood and you think you don't remember everything. And then turns out you remember everything. I would say the common denominator for all of them, going back to my high school English teacher and certainly my parents, but extending through the writers I admire, has really been embracing your weirdness, for maybe lack of a better term. And that's the thing that makes you special. It's the thing that in some ways we can feel like we need to hide, or we need to, you know, when you start in any field or any art, you're modeling after ones that you like, but they're inevitably not you. So you are already starting to sort of stifle yourself. But, you know, every art that's worth something feels completely idiosyncratic. And I think that the teachers that I've loved have sort of encouraged me to push into my own weirdness and to challenge myself to go even further in it. And that's a great thing. And the other thing I would say, they never saw any distinction between high culture, low culture, pop culture. The only thing they didn't like was middlebrow culture. But it's so... That was also the fact, you know, because I loved gangster movies as a kid and there was no judgment there. I loved comic books, but I was also reading Jane Eyre. There were no guilty pleasures, and that the teachers I respond to the most were the same way. And both those pieces of advice felt like great permission to be weird and to own what you like. And I think those feel like gifts for any creative person. This is my new book that comes out in the U.S. at the end of June. And basically, I chose a short section from the beginning, so you don't need to know much, just that it's about three sisters. And you know, one of their sons is graduating from high school, and they're all sort of at a precipice moment. And this is the scene from the graduation party that begins the book. Everyone assembled at Pam's rental house on El Dorado Drive for the graduation party she had been planning for weeks, maybe months. Planning it like it was a wedding, a royal wedding even, and Harper half expected her nephew Patrick to arrive in a horse-drawn carriage. "Mom, you don't have to do this," Patrick kept assuring her, worrying until the last minute that he might not make that gentleman C in trigonometry. "We can just hang out. It's cool." But Pam was the sister who planned parties, who hosted, who threw herself into everything with the sweaty fervor of a general readying her troops for the final battle, the one to win the war. It made sense when she was married to Doug, when she was president of the Junior League and chair of the Parents Club, when she lived in a 5-bedroom, 6-com mansion on the canopied boulevard near the lake and hosted 3 or more parties a month, dinner parties, fundraisers, meet and greets, luncheons, receptions. But those days were gone, long gone, which was maybe why this party meant far more, why it had the weight of a coronation, the eerie desperation of D-Day. "It's beautiful," Harper told her, barely catching her sister as she flitted in and out of the house with trays, bags of ice, bug spray. "I tried," Pam said with a sigh, the back of her hand on her forehead like a soap opera actress. "I just want him to remember it forever." They both stood for a minute to take it all in, the backyard glimmering with candles and string lights, Norseman green and gold balloons, a half dozen rented tables draped with gold linen, branches strung with miniature graduation cap streamers, garlands shimmying with graduation tassels, the ancient elm tree thick with bright paper lanterns, class of 2008. More than 20 years ago, Harper and her sister had celebrated their own graduations on the grand lawn of the Hunt Club, formal affairs that ended with all the parents drunk, their chairs tipping onto the grass, and all the kids escaping to after parties in paneled basements and rec rooms all through Grosse Pointe. Now, as the auto industry's fortunes sank, most graduation parties resembled this one, stuffed into the backyard of Pam's split-level rental house on the optimistically named El Dorado Drive, a street that would forever remain aspirational, close as it was to the shaggier St. Clair shores, a different county near the water, strange smells forever rising from the storm sewer drain. That 10-mile drain's giving everyone cancer, everyone always said. But would the people that live there even know the difference? But somehow Pam made it all work, as she always did. You never even noticed the pitted aluminum siding, the yellowing lawn, the painted-over window latches and sagging gutters. All you saw was Pam's magic.
Well, I thought about that a lot while writing the book, because we really are in the age of the grifter, as they keep saying. And in some ways, it's the most deeply American type, the hustler, the American aspiration. And I think mm-hmm. women and money. So I think that sort of was hovering in my head when I wrote the book, and how women persuade and convince one another of things feels particularly complex for me. I think there's so many layers to female relationships. That was really interesting to me to pursue, because in some ways it's much more veiled and sort of complex. That was sort of I tend to write about groups of women a lot, regardless of the field, but in particular the way they communicate or don't communicate or communicate without words to one another is an ongoing fascination of mine. Yes, Americans only want to talk about money, and they never talk about class, which is such a fascinating contradiction, where in Europe you can talk about class. And I think that really speaks to the really poisonous American dream idea that anybody can, if they work hard enough, pull up their bootstraps, can be a great success. And it's such a fantasy, but we were raised in that. It's in all our movies, our music. It's sort of so in the culture. So not only is there no shame in flaunting wealth or flaunting your hustle, there's actually great pride in it. I think there's this sort of, you know, serial killer is a good example, because there's sort of this fantasy of the kind of cold serial killer that is like a machine, but they're just more damaged versions of ourselves, you know, and there's a desire. They feel out of place. They don't belong, whether because they're a sociopath or, you know, they can't feel the things that they're supposed to be feeling. And there's a desire to be recognized. And I think that's something that we actually all have. And I think You know, I think we all reveal ourselves too. I really do believe in that sort of Freudian, like the Freudian slip, you know, all these sort of ways that we want to be caught in some ways. You see this in interpersonal, you know, cheating spouse, etc. There is desire. In that case, not for recognition, but maybe for feeling guilty. And I think those sort of the things we don't understand about ourselves, why we're doing what we're doing, is, I think, also the area I like to pursue most too. Why certain things stick with us and others don't, or why. I mean, my favorite filmmaker is David Lynch, who just passed away this year. And there's something sort of unconsciously he understood about our dark interiors, and I think that, you know, books, movies, all arts are a way for us to safely explore these dark parts of ourselves and come out not having hurt anyone or ourselves. So I always think about that. That's the art I respond to the most. The very little exaggeration from the feedback I've heard from cheerleaders and from ballet dancers. So even if they didn't always want to say it publicly, but I do write about athletes of one kind or another a lot. And I do think that's in large part because I have no athletic ability or the ability to dance, even though I tried for a long time. And I've never felt sort of full ownership of my body in that way. And I'm so sort of dazzled by it. And then sort of fascinated by how women, the body is both the prison and the escape. It's the source of, you're objectified, but it's also the source of all your power as an athlete. And so that all those sort of, you know, seeming contradictions are really kind of fascinating to me as this competition. The conflict which you see, especially in team sports like cheerleading, where there's both the individual achievement and the team achievement, and they're constantly at loggerheads with one another because that all feels really, it's just such ripe dramatic terrain, of course, but it's the perfect way of like pushing, you said dark fairy tale, and yeah, that's how I think of it. I mean, that's also how I think of high school, which is everything is pitched to how it feels, not necessarily to how it is in objective reality. Everything is super intensified, and that's a way to explore all the things that girls and women aren't supposed to say or feel. They're not supposed to have unbridled ambition. They're not supposed to express aggression. They're not supposed to really express desire as a teenage girl, and any kind of non-heteronormative desire at all. So all that, this sort of, these areas give me the freedom to let them do all those things. So because they're in these kind of closed circuits, the team, the squad, the dance school, where you can see them all laid bare. And they don't run the traditional room in many ways. You meet sporadically over two weeks period, then don't meet for a few months. Then, so they would be very intense. But what they taught me the most is really, because we were allowed to be on set, especially for episodes we wrote, but really we could come anytime, is what the showrunner's real job, which is being on set all the time. So you can control the tone of your show. Only you know what the tone of the scene should be. Only you know all these things that you don't think you know, but you have a vision in your head. And so it was so great to get to sit with them, you know, in the little chairs with the little, you know, playback, and see how they make their magic, their kind of dark magic. They were really very mentorly about that, and it was a great experience. And I definitely took that into Dare Me. It was a very different kind of show, obviously, but if I hadn't, I wouldn't have known how important it was to be there. I wouldn't have known how many questions get answered by people that aren't you if you're not there. and how thrilling it would be to collaborate with the called department heads. So costumes, art department, production design, cinematography, you know, how they would bring you better ideas than you ever had. And the show gets richer because of their contribution. So all that stuff was great. It was invaluable. Yeah, no, it's deeply upsetting. I don't think there's anything that's more upsetting to me right now. All the things to be upset about in the world, just because it feels like an existential threat to me. It's definitely a threat for a lot of people's livelihood. Thousands of professions are affected, but the existential threat is really what's reality and what's not. And that smack of authenticity, you're seeing something that's not real and you can't, it's that uncanny feeling that this is not right. And now we can tell because most of the AI is just awful and it's a slop. But eventually, of course, we won't be able to tell. And it is something I wish I could find a corner of hopefulness about it. But I will say the corner of hopefulness I feel is that, number one, it's wildly expensive. And number two, I do think people can tell right now. And maybe they're having fun with it on their own. But I think we really all do crave the touch of the real, the smack of authenticity. I think we need it as humans. And I have to believe in us as the human race that we will ultimately reject it.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.